Hello, this is Texas Tribune reporter Reeve Hamilton. Usually I host the Tribcast, but the Indigo Girls called and we're going out on tour for a few weeks. So Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune will be taking over. Take it away, Ben.
And thank you, Reeve. And just like always, whenever Reeve's on vacation, he's with some singer-songwriters.
Things are so much more pleasant around here when he's been deported.
You think, really?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I know that, you know, people were...
Although, let's see how you do with this thing.
Well, people are starting to pile garbage on his desk. I assume they think he'll...
I think he had to do the intro to that podcast because he was afraid that everyone was going to forget about him while he was gone.
Oh, that could be it. Well, hopefully I'll make this an extremely
memorable
event and people... Remember the good guy before that Philpott guy took over? So, yes, this is the Tribcast. Welcome. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in again this week. We hope you'll continue listening in the future. I am Ben Philpott from KUT, here with Texas Tribune executive editor Ross Ramsey.
This is going remarkably well so far, wouldn't you say?
I'm begging for people to listen. It's a fundraising mode already. And editor Emily Ramshaw, thanks.
Happy to be here, as always.
Education reporter Morgan Smith is sitting in this week for Evan Smith, no relation, and will do a much better job than Evan Smith, I'm sure.
No relation or resemblance.
Or resemblance. And the quality level is, you know, way up. You can't see we're on the radio, but anyway. And actually, we're going to pick on Morgan first. Let's talk about kind of the most breaking news story of the week, which is that the Texas Education Agency will soon need a new head. Robert Scott is leaving. So what's up with that?
So this is rumors about Commissioner Scott's departure have been circulating for a while, pretty much ever since he gave a speech at this annual school administrators conference in late January where he said...
Went off the reservation.
Well, he gave his most forceful comments ever on the state of testing in Texas, saying that standardized testing had gone too far. I think the exact phrase he used was that it had become a perversion of its original intent. And he kind of, just the whole tone of the speech kind of felt like a goodbye speech. And so that had kind of started the rumor mills working. And yesterday, which happened to be his birthday, he announced his resignation, and he'll stay on until July 2nd.
So let me ask you one question about that speech. Did it sound like a resignation speech, or could it have sounded like a speech of someone, you know, planning something new, but in Texas politics, since that wasn't the winds weren't blowing in that direction, it had to be a goodbye speech. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of looking at the sequence of events might interpret his leaving as possibly a result of him having been so outspoken in that speech, but I think that would be the incorrect way to interpret it. I think this is something that the commissioner has been planning. I think this is something that he's doing of his own accord, especially when you look at the history of his time at the agency. He was interim commissioner for a while before he took over. So if you look back, he's really been in one of the top, if not the top position there for about 9 years, which is a long time.
Is that longer than anybody else?
It is. It's longer than anyone else in the past two decades where, like, the chief at the agency has been in its current form. So
he was Perry's education guy before he went over to the education agency. Are he and Perry on the same page on testing?
I think that's kind of the question of the day. I think that Perry hasn't really given much of an indication since Commissioner Scott gave that speech that they aren't on the same page. But if you look at reaction to Commissioner Scott's speech after he gave it, you saw people like Bill Hammond, Senator Shapiro coming out and saying, we do not know where Commissioner Scott is coming from. He's never said anything like this before. And Commissioner Scott has not given any kind of public remarks since then. I think last week or 2 weeks ago at the State Board of Education meeting was the first time that he has really had any kind of public appearance. So I think that's an interesting thing to note when we're thinking about that.
So the Perry folks have been very quick to say, like, you know, there is no bad blood here. You know, he's leaving on his own accord. Is there any indication, any sort of rumblings beneath the surface that this was, that he was forced out at all, or that there was any, like, sort of big disagreement?
There really isn't. I think being commissioner of education, in Texas is a bit of a thankless job because you are being pulled in all kinds of directions. And I think it's one that both requires a lot of political savvy and also a lot of policy knowledge.
He was basically forced to say that the budget cuts were, you know, that they could manage the budget cuts.
Exactly, during the legislative session.
That was, that to me was the first crack in the ice, was that when he was talking to, I think it was Senate Finance during the last legislative session, and they said, can you do it without this $4 billion? And he said, you're asking a guy on the operating table whether he wants lungs or a heart back.
Right,
right.
But then he said, we'll make it work, which, I mean, I think that's a great example of just the position that he's in.
We can kind of say that about all the agency heads, right?
Right.
I mean, all of them came before and said, oh, we'll be fine. Big smile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Tom Cease, basically that same day that Robert Scott, you know, quote unquote, went off the reservation. Wasn't that the same day that Tom Cease, HHSC commissioner, also sort of went off the reservation and said, you know, we're facing a $15 to $17 billion Medicaid shortfall. You know, I mean, that was sort of the day that you could see everybody in the governor's office just like pulling their hair out. You know?
People will die. Rogue, that was right.
Yeah. All their rogue commissioners. Right. Right. So,
well, what's next for TEA? You said this is a thankless job, so who's the next sucker?
Or who? What's next for him? And how does this work with revolving door stuff?
Right. Yeah, well, we can take what's next for the TEA first. And I think that is something that we have to look at. You know, what is going to be Governor Perry's motivation in who he picks for this job? Is he going to want to pick somebody that pleases kind of his core constituency, which would be school reform type people who are big into school choice, homeschoolers, the business community type folks? Or is he going to want to pick somebody as a kind of peace offering to this kind of more traditional education community who has more experience, what we might think of as a traditional candidate for the job, a former superintendent or somebody who is even within the agency right now? And I think, or, you know, there could be some candidate that combines both, you know, strengths from both of those camps that would come through.
The last superintendent who had it kind of went off the reservation, too, Shirley Neely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know Perry will be wary of that. That's usually the model. It's usually been, you know, Skip Mino and Mike Moses and Bill Kirby. You know, all those are former superintendents. So.
Yeah, or school board people. Right. Or he could pick somebody from out of the political world, you know, somebody like Rob Eisler, or was a name that I kind of heard thrown. I have heard thrown around, but
Grusendorf, Kent Grusendorf's meeting with the TAB in a press conference today on education.
Grusendorf is somebody who has a background in politics, education policy, somebody who you know, would be appealing to the school reform types. You know, there's a lot of names out there. The problem with picking a superintendent is that if you look at salaries of superintendents, they're much higher than what this of a strong superintendent of a big school district. They're much higher than what the Commissioner of Education gets paid. So that's kind of an interesting, it would need to be somebody who is really coming into the job because they wanted to be there. It's not necessarily a career move upward wise salary if you look at salaries.
Huh. Very interesting.
Well, I guess that's it on that.
yeah, right. Nothing left to talk
about. Well, I guess, you know, I guess the thing I'm curious about is whether, you know, and it doesn't sound like we know this yet. Is this a change in direction or is this just a change of personnel?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what, you know, there's been talk within the superintendent community. Speaking of superintendents, you know, they've really been pushing for the whole idea of, you know, so what if we went to, the TEA and said, we're done with this testing thing. We don't like it. We agree with the former commissioner. We think something has to be changed. You know, there. I would assume that there are right now the same voices that were being gathered for that are being gathered to say, you know, here's what we would like to see in the next commissioner.
It seems like it has to be a policy person. I just cannot. I just don't think that putting a political person in there would serve the purpose. I just think there would be such an outcry if it wasn't somebody who, like, you know, really truly knew their stuff.
Right.
Well, and this is the same person who's going to have to not necessarily lead the discussion, but be involved with what happens with the school lawsuits and a new funding formula system and all that mess that we're going to have in the next, 2 years?
Right. The next fight on education, the, you know, sort of the next immediate fight is going to be money.
Scott Huckberg's available. I guess they could.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he and Perry.
I don't think that's their choice.
I mean, the first thing they're going to try to do is, you know, what are we? Can we get this $4 billion back or $5 billion? And are we going to have the money available to cover inflation and population growth in the next budget? I mean, it's kind of the same thing Tom Seas walked into over at HHSC. It's like, first, a financial crisis.
Right, right. I mean, maybe they need a budget wonk over there.
Right, that's exactly right.
So, and maybe that, in that case, the superintendent that who has had to make, you know, sort of big reductions in the last, you know, cycle isn't the most logical choice. Somebody who's not afraid of the knife.
Right.
Well, there are still lawmakers, several running for office in the state legislature, who will tell you that the education budget wasn't cut in the last session.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how many of those people get elected and how that message that nothing was cut. So it doesn't matter if we cut this time, you know, how that goes forward in the next legislative session. Let's move from one battle to another. How about the battle over funding Planned Parenthood? That's a fun one, too.
Sure, this is my favorite topic to talk about every week.
And well,
it changes every day. Another judge came in and said another thing.
I know. Right. We've had two changes just since
the
start of the week.
Basically 24 hours, yeah. All right, so just, you know, catching up to speed, basically what we're supposed to be, take the lawsuits off the table, what is supposed to be happening right now is that the state is supposed to be disenrolling Planned Parenthood providers from the women's health program. They announced that they were going to do that between May 1st and May 15th.
Disenrolling?
Unenrolling?
This is the government word. It's got to be, right?
Yes. right.
I'm sure they call it that.
They are reverse enrolling providers from the women's health program. So basically, so that was supposed to start happening. And then, of course, you know, waiting in the wings on this, what Planned Parenthood had filed, basically asked for a restraining order, basically had asked a district judge to say, no, no, you know, stop this disenrolling. So they got that. A district judge ruled, earlier this week that they could grant this temporary injunction and that the state could not start removing Planned Parenthood clinics from the women's health program.
The judge said freeze it.
Judge said, hold, right, stop, can't do this. So everyone, you know, Planned Parenthood everybody was sort of jumping for joy, but also doing a little bit quietly because this is a district judge, you know, in Austin. We're used to this. We know this, where this storyline goes. And where the storyline very quickly went, like maybe not even 24 hours later, was to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal court, where they said, that restraining order, that injunction that you all just got, I'm putting an injunction basically on that injunction, which is, you know, how many double negatives can you use here?
So now it's
so now it basically says to the state, feel free to go ahead and start disenrolling Planned Parenthood clinics from this program. And, oh, by the way, Planned Parenthood, you have until 5 p.m. on Tuesday to, you know, follow up with us, you know, provide another brief, and then we'll make, you know, yet another decision. So
this
basically,
is the Tuesday ahead of us or the Tuesday behind us?
Tuesday behind us.
Okay.
So basically, we have two court orders in this week. We are waiting for, you know, another sort of final ruling on this. But in the meantime, the state has said they are going to go ahead and start kicking Planned Parenthood out of this program. Now, the sort of confounding factor here is the original Planned Parenthood lawsuit was filed at the time when the feds were still involved in this program. And they were saying, this is a federal program. You can't kick us out of this program. In the meantime, the state has said, okay, you're right. We don't want to be part of this federal program. We don't even want this to be a Medicaid program. We're going to find the money to run this as a state program. So Planned Parenthood's standing is not so strong when the feds aren't in the program because, you know, at that point, again, it's not a federal program, so the state may be able to do what it wants. It puts Planned Parenthood in the situation of fighting, you know, against sort of bigger picture like First Amendment issues as opposed to just, you know, we're being wrongfully excluded from, you know, a federal program.
But in essence, they're in a position of sitting out there saying, we want to provide these services, and the only way we're going to do it is with public funding of some kind.
Right.
And so yesterday they said, or earlier this week, they said, we're going to continue to allow these women's health program patients to come to us, even though we know we may not get any money from the state, and they'll still be able to come for free. At least initially, that was what
I mean. I think initially,
is.
I think it's just that's sort of going to be, you know, just a matter of time to figure out how their funding situation looks. Now, remember, these three big Planned Parenthood branches in Texas just merged, or are going to be merging officially. It'll start this summer. So, you know, we're in a situation where there is probably more funding available to try to make this work, to try to be flexible. Meanwhile, the state health department is working, you know, overtime to try to find new providers, to try to persuade, you know, docs in rural areas or low-income communities to take 10, 15, 20 women's health program patients so that they can try to sort of make up the difference here.
Because that was 45% of the program was running through.
40% of patients. Yeah.
But at these Planned Parenthood clinics, while we're waiting for all these legal issues to be sorted out, I mean, what is the daily life like there? Are they still taking patients? Do they have to wait? I mean, are their doors closed right now?
So their doors are not closed. So the clinics that were enrolled in this program still exist and still are treating patients, you know, whether they're women's health program patients or not. They are soon, if the state does go through with this, they're soon no longer going to be able to get this sort of state funding for a particular subset of very poor women. And for some clinics, like for some regions, that's $1 million or $2 million a year. It's a big deal. I think in North Texas, it's like $6 million.
North Texas, up around Dallas-Fort Worth, right?
This is not like pocket change. I mean, these organizations make a lot of revenue other ways, but this money is not, you know, a pittance for them. So basically, without the Women's Health Program money, we can expect to see more Planned Parenthood clinics close around the state, which frankly was the stated goal of, you know, removing
Is there any clear line here that this is having any effect on abortions in the state? I mean, you know, the line here for some of the people that wanted to defund Planned Parenthood was Planned Parenthood affiliates are providing abortions. If we defund Planned Parenthood, then we have some negative effect on their ability to provide abortions. But what it looks like here, just on the face of it, on the first day, is the abortion business is untouched here. And the women's health services business, it's not abortions, is the one that's getting torn up. I'm just wondering if there's any downhill,
downstream effect. Abortion has been private pay here for years.
Right.
So, you know, you haven't been able to get a state-subsidized abortion, you know. So basically, that is still sort of the private industry. I think the idea behind this is Planned Parenthood is predominantly the organization that does provide abortions. So if we can force them out of business other ways, then we can, you know, tie their hands so they can't perform abortions.
So eventually this will hurt that business.
Eventually. That's the idea. Right. You know, I think, again, we are still probably 2 or 3 or 4 years out from really having any clear sense what the numbers look like. I think if you watched our colleague Ton Tan had a really great piece last week on women's health in this big program at UT that's really doing sort of a nonpartisan, you know, completely scientific study looking at, you know, what do pregnancy rates look like? What do birth rates look like? What do abortion rates look like over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years? You know, only time is really going to tell how big of an effect this is having, if any.
And I mean, is there any possibility that there's going to be this funding battle is going to come back again in 2013? I mean, unless there's some real legislature.
I mean, they can try, but there's not very much money left. You know, the family planning dollars went down from $111 million a biennium to like $36 million a biennium. So
they've got to scratch for this money again, though, right?
I mean, for the 36?
Right now, they're kind of shaking the couch to get money in the cushions to sort of
for the
turn this into
program.
A state program.
Right. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's a $40 million, $35 million a year program. At the end of the day, they are, I think the state is, you know, feels so like they've had to sort of stick up for themselves and say, we're going to run this program, you know, without your help, that if they dropped the program, it would look like they'd failed. And I don't think Perry's going to let that happen. So, but I still don't, you know, the abortion fight is going to come back this session because it always does. But I don't think it's going to be a funding fight the way it has been in the past, because I just don't think there's enough money left in the program to make it a funding fight.
But the continuing fight on women's health services is going to be, how do you provide a statewide program without Planned Parenthood in the net?
And what Perry will say is $40 million is not a lot of money. It's a drop in the bucket in our budget.
But he has to find doctors willing to take that money.
But the issue,
provider.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
It seems like the issue is, you know, even if you have the money, you don't have the providers in certain parts of the state.
That is the criticism. Again, it's sort of too soon to know that. I mean, there may be, because it's no longer a Medicaid program, the state isn't tied to Medicaid reimbursement rates. So if they needed to say, okay, we need to up these rates to get more providers to sign on, they might be able to get doctors who have foregone Medicaid because
they're paying
the
more.
Pay is so crappy, right, to, you know, sign back up for this program.
They could also say, we can't find as much money as we'd like, we're going to lower the rates again.
Right.
I mean, but we just don't know,
like
you said.
And, you know, there's this argument, and this is the argument Perry's staff will make, you know, that we are being too we don't believe that, you know, women are smart enough to find their way to a clinic that does provide these services, smart enough to find the doctor or the provider who does. You know, there's this argument that, again, we just have to wait and see if these women can actually get there and get these services without having Planned Parenthood. So right. I think, again, really too soon to know where they're going to go, you know, where they're going to find care, whether there's going to be care available. The health department thinks so.
Well, the last thing we were going to talk about today is the coming, eventually, we'll finally get here, the Texas primary at the end of May. But before we just jump on individual races, I wanted to ask, is there any indication that this argument and kind of the greater global argument of women's health that is going on in the presidential campaign, does that look like it's having any kind of, is it sticking here at all in Texas as people are out campaigning?
I don't see much, if any of it. It is just not on the list.
I don't know if you can name a race. I don't know if you can name a race where this is the first thing or the third thing or the sixth thing that comes up in the debate. I mean, they're talking about education funding. I mean, we're back to back to Morgan on that. I mean, they're talking about education funding. They're talking about taxes. You know, all the regular stuff.
So this is a demilitarized zone in the war on women.
Now, this may play...
No, it just hasn't matured into a political fight.
Okay, but, I mean, wait till the general, you know. Right. Yeah. You may see this is not going to be something that a Republican candidate running in a primary is going to plaster on their campaign literature. It just isn't.
If somebody on one side or the other looks up and sees a crowd of voters, you know, women voters or whatever they are, running in a particular direction, then it becomes a fight. And if they look at this, you know, like you could argue maybe on education at the moment, the voters haven't really reacted to this... to the education cuts yet in a way that's, you know, exploitable for a politician, you know, and it, in some parts of the state they have. But, you know, you look at this and you say, okay, so until I have some people yelling about this, I don't really have a crowd I can appeal to.
Well, I'm saying the woman vote is like saying the Latino vote or this any sort of overarching, it's nebulous, you know?
Right.
I mean, you can't say that they're, that women overarchingly feel one way about this issue. It's as divided, you know, among women as it is among men. So.
Right.
Well, getting a little further on into the election season, we have a big rally coming up this weekend here in Austin. The Tea Party Express, the national, one of the national Tea Party groups with the buses that Sarah Palin likes to follow around a lot. They're going to be here in Austin at the state capitol on Sunday. And their very special guest stars are Ron and Rand Paul, along with several other Texas candidates who would like to see their support at the polls.
You know, I think if you said we're going to have a Tea Party rally at the Texas Capitol, you would get a crowd of size X. But if you say Ron Paul is having a rally, even without tea, say Ron and or Rand Paul are showing up at the Capitol, I think it's going to be 5X. I think the Tea Party is almost incidental to this thing. I think, you know, Ron Paul is closing his campaign like, you know, we talked about he probably would. He's still got a large... and, you know, fervent following. It's just not large enough to win a Republican primary.
So you're saying we're going to see more signs that say "in the Fed" and "let people drink raw milk" than Tea Party signs?
I think this is a Ron Paul crowd and not more than it is a Tea Party crowd. I think they, you know, they overlap some, but I think Ron Paul's the draw here.
Well, so what about those that are kind of using it as a piggybacking on the Tea Party Express to get that support? You know, Ted Cruz, U.S. Senate candidate, is going to be there.
Ted Cruz sees a crowd of voters who he thinks will vote for Ted Cruz. I mean, I don't think he would care if they were, you know, there for Kool-Aid. If they're there and they're the kind of voters that are going to that he can appeal to. I mean, he can go in front of that crowd and say, you know, I share Ron Paul's fiscal ideas. I share your ideas about incumbents. I'm not an establishment Republican. I've never held office. You know, let's go take the castle. And, you know, if he can get those people behind him, you know, that's just a big opportunity for somebody like that.
And so how much does that opportunity, how much can that turn into votes for Ted Cruz? You know, we tend to talk about
what
how
he says.
Well, and we tend to talk about the whole Senate race, especially as, you know, not who's going to win on May 29th, but who are the two people that are going to get into a runoff. And what does that mean, you know, moving forward?
Well, you know, Dewhurst is clearly trying to get to 50.1%. You know, so that he doesn't have to go to July and worry about a runoff at all. And everybody else is trying to finish second. You know, right now it looks like Tom Leppard and Ted Cruz are the guys to watch. Leppard has more money and probably more ability to get on TV. Advertising in the state at the statewide level runs about $2 million a week. Right now, as of their latest reports, it looks like Leppard can do that and Cruz can't. Cruz has a better grassroots campaign. And I think that's why you see him going to things like the Ron Paul rally on Sunday. You know, that doesn't cost $2 million.
Right.
It's going to get a bunch of free media, and he's going to be talking to a bunch of people who talk to a bunch of people who talk to a bunch of people.
Will it get a bunch of free media? I mean, we usually ignore Ron Paul.
I don't know, Ben, are you going?
We usually ignore Ron Paul, though. I mean, that's just kind of the standard media response, right?
He got a huge crowd at UT. He got,
email me. I'm joking, okay?
Has anyone else been getting all the emails?
I'm teasing.
Ben Philpott.
I'm joking. I got plenty of emails from him last week.
He has a big crowd, but they can't produce or have not yet produced in his career sufficient numbers to win these primaries. And you have to win the primaries. I mean, Paul's gotten a lot of attention. People generally know what his views are. People have generally had a chance to look at him. And he's got to win a primary.
And his supporters claim that they have won at least four primaries by going back in the state convention or the precinct conventions and taking over those precincts and forcing the delegates to be for Ron Paul. Not forcing, but through the process, getting the delegates to be for Ron Paul instead of for whoever won the popular vote in that primary. They're claiming Iowa, Minnesota, Alaska, and Louisiana, I believe, and maybe another one.
You have to win enough big states or pull a big enough crowd that the front runner, in this case Romney, has to consider you. You know, one of the plays here is to, you know, and one of the Tea Party plays, and one of the, you know, such as, you know, the Tea Party is not really an organized party, but the people that are sort of in that faction have sort of started circulating these lists of people who would be acceptable vice presidential candidates. And Rand Paul is really high on those lists. Ron's not, but Rand is. So, you know, there's still a play there. Ron Paul has clearly gotten some of his ideas into the mix. I mean, stuff he was talking about 20 years ago is now part of the platform for the Republican Party. But they haven't been able to make him a viable presidential candidate in the Republican primaries this year.
Well, once again, we've tried to make another viable podcast for you talking about Texas politics. And if you have any questions or comments about what our efforts here today, please email us at tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Emily and Morgan and Ross and our producer Todd, I'm Ben Philpott. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, it's actually called Herbal Mate instead of Yerba Mate.
Huh. I do not.
I made that up.